From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nancy Mares is a Catholic and a feminist. On today's Fresh Air, we'll discuss her new memoir, Ordinary Time. She describes it as the story of how one woman deals with God's presence day after day. A moral inquiry, not a moral preachment. Also today, a talk with the producer and the writer of the new film In the Line of Fire, which stars Clint Eastwood as a burnt-out Secret Service agent. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Orlando, based on the Virginia Woolf story about a man who is transformed into a woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today, President Clinton presented what he called an honorable compromise on allowing gays to serve in the military. The policy allows gays to serve if they keep their sexual orientation secret. The president said it allows soldiers to be judged on their conduct, not their status. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
The president announced his policy before a military audience, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff flanking him. This compromise, said Mr. Clinton, will end witch hunts for homosexuals in the military and allow those gay men and lesbians who are discreet to serve without fear of discharge.
It is the best way to proceed because it provides a sensible balance between the rights of the individual and the needs of our military to remain the world's number one fighting force.
The president says this is not a policy that will please everyone, but given the political climate, he felt this was the best compromise. The president said those who want the ban to be lifted completely should understand that such action would have faced certain reversal by Congress. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Court documents filed today in connection with the investigation of the House Post Office suggest that Illinois Congressman Dan Rostenkowski may have received embezzled funds. Postmaster Robert Rota pleaded guilty today to charges that he embezzled post office money that was used to provide an illegal source of cash for one current and one former member of Congress. The congressmen involved were not named, but the court documents contained dates and amounts of vouchers that were used in the illegal scheme. The Associated Press reports that those dates and amounts match those of House Ways and Means Chief Rostenkowski and former Representative Joseph Coulter in previous public records. The men, both Democrats, have previously denied any wrongdoing. Prosecutors in Detroit rested their case today against three white police officers charged in the beating death of a black man. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
Malice Green died on a night last November after being beat repeatedly with heavy police flashlights. Prosecution witnesses say officers Walter Budson and Larry Nevers, who are on trial for murder, began hitting Green when Green refused to open his clenched hand after he was confronted in front of a crack house. A third officer is charged with assault for allegedly kicking Green. Defense attorney Michael Batchelor now begins presenting his side of the story. He says witnesses on the scene that night will have a different account of the incident than the one that has emerged so far.
I think the jury needs to get a total overview of what took place out there.
Defense attorneys are expected to take much less time presenting their cases than the prosecution did. Jury deliberations in the trial could begin by the end of this month. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
The Dow Industrials gained 7 points today. This is NPR News. President Clinton has added Nebraska and South Dakota to the list of states he's declaring as disaster areas because of the massive flooding. The declaration makes flood victims in those states eligible for federal assistance, including money for temporary housing, home repair, and unemployment assistance. Federal disaster aid can also be applied to business loans and repairs to roads and utilities. The Colombian government has issued a report claiming security forces have completely disrupted the activities of the Medellin drug cartel. But a year after his escape from a luxurious prison, gang leader Pablo Escobar is still at large. Leslie Werpser reports from Bogota.
In a report issued to President Cesar Gaviria, army, police, and intelligence officials say they have literally wiped out the Medellin cartel. The report says that over the past year, a special strike force in Medellin has arrested over 1,000 suspects and killed 145 people allegedly linked to the organization. The Colombian government has spent almost $13 million in the past 12 months battling the Medellin drug ring, but Pablo Escobar is still free. Even attacks against his lawyers and family members by a paramilitary group called the Pepes have not forced Escobar to surrender again. Escobar reportedly wants his family members to receive asylum outside of the country before he turns himself in. Chances that the Escobar clan will be received abroad are slim. The Chilean government recently deported one of Escobar's nephews and his immediate family. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
President Clinton fired FBI Director William Sessions today, bringing an end to months of controversy over allegations that Sessions violated ethical standards. A Justice Department report released in January alleged that Sessions evaded income taxes on the use of his official limousine and used FBI aircraft for personal travel. Attorney General Janet Reno told the president that Sessions exhibited a serious deficiency in judgment. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a Catholic and feminist, Nancy Mears knows she set herself up for some spiritual, social, and intellectual dilemmas. She writes about some of them in her new memoir, Ordinary Time. She describes her book as a 20th century version of the spiritual autobiographies undertaken by her Puritan foremothers, aimed at harmonizing the divine, the secular, and the personal. Faith has not relieved her of pain and inner torment. Mears suffers from multiple sclerosis. She's been an agoraphobic and has been suicidally depressed. When she was writing her memoir, her husband was getting chemotherapy for treatments for cancer. Ordinary Time is Mears' fourth book. Writer Francine Prose described this new memoir as a small miracle of honesty mediated by dignity and humor. I asked Nancy Mears to begin with a reading from the opening of Ordinary Time.
Hear, Grace. You will love me, my husband asks, and at something in his tone my consciousness rouses like a startled cat, ears pricked, pupils round and onyx black. Never voluble, he has been unusually subdued this evening. Thinking him depressed about the mysterious symptoms that have plagued him for months, and that we know in our heart of hearts signal a recurrence of cancer, although the tests won't confirm it for several more days, I pressed up against him on the couch and whispered against his neck, "This may be the most troublesome time of our lives, but I'm so happy." This awareness of joy, though it's been growing for several years now, has recently expanded in response to my own failing health. A few weeks ago, pondering the possibility that I might die at any moment, I posed myself a new question. If I died at this very moment, would I die happy? And the answer burst out without hesitation, yes. Since then, in spite of my fears, I've felt a new contentment. What more could I ever ask than to give an unequivocal response to such a question? His silence persisted. Scared, I asked him after a few moments, thinking of the doctor's appointment that morning, the CAT scan scheduled for later in the week. Head resting on the back of the couch, eyes closed, he nodded. More silence. Finally, I said, "George, you know how I love words. I need words. And now, words. You will love me." Behind his glasses, his eyes have the startled look I associate incongruously with the moment of orgasm. "Yes," I tell him, alert. I see all over. I can safely promise you that. I will always love you. "You asked the other day whether my illness could be AIDS," he said unevenly. "I'm pretty sure it isn't, because I had the test for HIV some time ago, after I had an affair for a couple of years with another woman." The sensation is absolutely nonverbal. But everybody knows it, even without words. The stunned breathlessness that follows a jab to the solar plexus. What will astonish me in the days to come is that this sensation can sustain itself long after one would expect to be dead of asphyxiation. I have often wished myself dead. If it were possible to die of grief, I would die at this moment. But it's not, and I don't. A couple of years. A couple of years. This was no fit of passion, no passing fancy, but a sustained commitment. He loved her, loves her still. Their relationship, until he broke it off, for reasons having little to do with me, was a kind of marriage, he says. Time after time after time he went to her, deliberately, telling whatever lies he needed to free himself from me and the children, and later from his mother when she came for a protracted visit after his father's death, throughout at least a couple of years.
Thank you for reading that, Nancy. It's Nancy Mayer's reading from her new memoir, Ordinary Time. When I started reading this passage, I thought it was going to be about another person who grows more loving and virtuous every day after being struck with catastrophe. And the affair really threw me. Of course, it felt like real life. And I was wondering why you started a spiritual autobiography with a story about your husband's affair.
I think that's where spiritual life really begins, is in the very earthy and often painful realities of our lives. We don't develop a spiritual life and then fit in what happens to us. The spiritual life grows out of crisis, I think. And so I began where I felt that such life develops.
Of course, as a Catholic, you believe in forgiveness. What did you think of forgiving your husband for this affair?
What surprised me was that when I talked with a priest who asked if I could ever do so, I discovered that I already had. Although I'd never had to confront the issue explicitly, I can think all the way back to college with my roommate saying, boy, if some guy ever cheated on me, that'd be the last time he ever saw me. And I said, I don't think I would respond that way. And all those years later, 30 years later, I got put to the test, and I guess in my own eyes, I passed.
Why didn't you respond that way?
I think that relationships in my life, the ones that I want to cling to, are more important than anything else. I was 4 and a half when my father died. And so I never had very much of a relationship with him. But it made for me, you know, keeping the people I loved about the most important thing in the world.
When you hear a confession like this, it kind of casts that whole period of your life into a different light. I mean, throughout those 2 years of the affair, things weren't what you thought they were. Did you find yourself replaying the film of your life from those 2 years and reinterpreting the whole thing?
Yes, over and over and over again. One of the things that haunted me the most, I have asked him time and again, and he doesn't, either can't or won't answer, was, what did I believe? What did you tell me when you were going to her that I believed and I just let you go? That haunts me, that I believed everything he told me all the way along, and he told me all those lies. For some reason, that's more important to me than the actual sexual transgression.
Mm-hmm.
Is the lack of faith between us during that period.
In an earlier essay, you wrote, "Dismayingly few marriages survive the multiple sclerosis test, and why should they?" Did you feel that this was part of the test in a way that well, it's because you have MS that he was cheating on you?
I have long felt amazed that he would even stay. Self-image is a real problem with a chronic progressive disease, and I think, you know, I'm a horrible failing cripple, and why doesn't he go get a good, healthy woman? So I think I did justify his action in those terms, and he justified it to himself also. That's one of the things he tells me, is that part of the reason he did this was because of my MS. And yet he didn't leave. It was as though if he had someplace to retreat to from it for a while, he was willing to come back.
Your husband has cancer.
He does, yes.
So he's in the position now of needing care himself. Do you think...
He is, although at the moment we're enjoying a truly miraculous remission.
Good.
And so he has gone back to being my caregiver with no difficulty. He's feeling physically strong and able. But, of course, we live under that shadow, knowing that at some point he will not be able to continue doing this. And I mind terribly the fact that I will not be able to give him any physical care at all. I really can scarcely move. And I have to work on myself, and he helps me in this, to remember that there are other kinds of care than physical, and I hope to God that I'll be available for those. I have been, and I hope I still have the courage to do it when I have to.
Do you ever feel like you're living out some kind of story of Job, you know? that you've just been hit with too much?
Yes, I do. I sometimes think, you know, it's really not very fair to give the family that has MS in it the melanoma too. And I have a little passage in Ordinary Time where I talk about what I would do if I were God. I wouldn't do this sort of thing. But there are all kinds of terrible things that I would do, so it's just as well I'm not God. I will just go on being Nancy, and to be serious now, I've been facetious, but to be serious, I do not at all see these as the hand of God, punishment or anything like that. I see what's happened to us as random happenings. Perhaps like winning the lottery, only nowhere near as much fun. In other words, I don't believe in a fair universe at all.
Right after you found out about your affair, your husband was sick and would really need your comfort and support. And did you feel like, well, yeah, I'm going to give that to you now after what you did to me?
No, but I did think about giving it to Sandra, his ex-lover. I did think to myself, well, how come she got the sex and I get the death? We'll see how good she is at the bedside. You know, I had those cynical feelings. But in fact, no, I was just so grateful, Terry, to have him for as long as I could keep him, that I really didn't feel that way. I just wanted him to stay. He was dying of cancer. And he could do anything as far as I was concerned if he just would stay. And he has for a couple of years now. All sweet borrowed time. I'm grateful for that.
My guest is writer Nancy Mayers, whose new memoir is called Ordinary Time. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nancy Mayers, author of the new memoir, Ordinary Time. I believe you were in your 20s when you converted to Catholicism.
In my 30s.
In your 30s.
Yes.
Were friends and family baffled at not only your conversion, but at your religion? I mean, did you find that a lot of people couldn't understand how you could be religious? Did they feel that it kind of went against your intellectualism?
Yes, I certainly think that a lot of people still can say, Nancy Mayers is so intelligent. How can she also believe this mumbo-jumbo? In fact, I just had a letter from my step-grandmother asking precisely that question, or rather saying with some relief, I'm so glad that I've read your book now and understand that you don't believe all that mumbo-jumbo. Mine is a very intellectualized Catholicism, I think, in that I do think about it all the time. I don't just mindlessly follow it along.
You were brought up a Congregationalist. Why did you convert to Catholicism?
Well, I can't think of anything more different from Congregationalism, so perhaps we could put it down to some sort of rebellion. I don't think so, though. I think a lot had to do with my life experiences, and I talk in the book about both the aesthetic ones. I studied a lot of art and music and literature, in which Catholicism has had a great hand. And also, I became increasingly involved in social justice issues. And the community that I'm affiliated with in Tucson, we are all deeply involved in that. And so I was sort of called into that community by their commitment to sanctuary, work with Central American refugees, and other similar issues. We do a lot of work with the homeless.
Once when you were in church and you were feeling very bad physically, you prayed to God and you said, "Dear God, please heal me." And then you heard a voice.
I did, although it's not like hearing a voice from the outside. These words simply formed in my consciousness. "But I am." That was the response to my prayer to be healed.
As in, "But I am healing you?"
"But I am healing you," yes. And so, as I say in the book, I've been stuck ever since with trying to plumb that prayer and its response. How someone as devastated by a neurological degenerative disease can be being healed, maybe not even in spite of that, but in part through that experience. That's a great puzzle to me.
In your writing over the years, you've been very honest about your suicidal depressions, your multiple sclerosis, and agoraphobia. And you know, you've written about this in detail. You also once wrote a piece on the literature of personal disaster. Do you see your writing as falling into that category?
Yes. The piece that I wrote about this said, you know, that I call it the literature of personal disaster, only half facetiously. So I'm a little having my tongue in my cheek when I use it. But I do find that a large number of books are published out of people's experience of pain, sorrow, suffering. And the surprising thing about that is that those are certainly qualities subject to enormous sentimentality and even bathos. But a surprising number of these books are really awfully good as books, as pieces of literature.
What do you think separates the really good literature about personal suffering from the, I don't know, more voyeuristic or sentimental books of its kind?
For me, it has a lot to do with language and the capacity to use language in ways that distinguish one's experience from other people's, so that you get a kind of combination going of identification. The reader can identify, because all readers have sorrows and pains of their own. And yet the reader is excited by the very individuality of the voice talking about these common experiences. So that someone like, I use Mae Sarton as an example in that essay that you refer to. One doesn't read Mae in order to hear an 80-year-old woman complain. One reads Mae because she creates a wonderful atmosphere. And it happens that that atmosphere is now being created by a suffering 80-year-old woman.
Do you read a lot of books about people's personal suffering?
I read a lot of books about all kinds of things, and for that reason, and the fact that I don't have much time, generally my reading of books about personal suffering is confined to professional activities. That is, I'm about to review a book for the Washington Post that deals with a woman's husband's death. And I'm sure that they got in touch with me because I've developed a kind of expertise in these matters.
Yeah, the queen of personal suffering.
Right. The connoisseur of catastrophe, I think I've called myself. Sometimes I would like, of course, to shake that off and free myself of it. And in fact, I review off and on for the New York Times, for instance, and they are good about not typing me narrowly, but about giving me a range of books to look at.
I think that pop culture has, in a way, become obsessed with suffering. You know, like the movie of the week is always about somebody's cancer or miscarriage or, you know, the murder of their teenage daughter or something. And, you know, I think a lot of the talk shows are obsessed with it also. And
Horribly.
Yeah. And is it snobbish of me to say, well, I really enjoy the really good, well-written literature on the subject, but a lot of this stuff just strikes me as cheap and voyeuristic, and why are we so obsessed with it? What are your thoughts about why our culture is so obsessed with it, not just the best of its kind, but the real cheap stuff, too?
And in fact, I think they prefer the real cheap stuff because it tends to be cast into clichés.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that's sort of formulaic. You don't have to have a direct experience with a cliché. It's a formula that everybody has sort of generally agreed on, but you don't have to really apply it deeply to your own life.
You won't be challenged in any way. It won't contradict what you think you're supposed to feel.
That's right. That's right. And so I would suggest to you that such things as those television movies and those talk shows are, in fact, a means for people to distance themselves from suffering, to pretend that it's really not so bad, that it can be, this is one I really hate, if you work hard enough, you can do anything you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I could work from now till doomsday, and I will never stand and walk again. And I want to. Oh, I can't tell you, Terry, how I want to get up and walk. And that's a terrible thing to do to people, to give them that message. But that's one of the clichés. And as long as you can stand up and walk, you can mouth that cliché, and it will seem to keep my disaster at a distance from you. If this happened to me, you can say, I would want to walk so badly I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that actually those things are doing a real injustice to people with disabilities and to the general population in making them not experience genuine human suffering and loss, and discovering the dimensions of those experiences that are transcendent.
How is your health now?
My general health isn't bad at all, but I get weaker and weaker and weaker, so that I'm definitely looking at a time when I really can't move or perhaps even feed myself. One of my great concerns, of course, has been whether I could touch the keyboard and continue to write.
Right.
And that has been resolved by a gift from an anonymous donor of software that will enable me to speak my words and have them pop up on the computer screen.
That's great.
Voice-activated software.
That's great.
So I'm hoping that I can continue to write, at least for a while longer.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm so glad I had the chance. Thank you.
Nancy Mayer's new memoir is called Ordinary Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why it took 9 years to make the movie In the Line of Fire. We'll talk with producer Jeff Apple, who came up with the idea, and with Jeff McGuire, who wrote the screenplay. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Orlando, based on the Virginia Woolf novel about a man who changes gender. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton today announced his policy on gays in the military. The president's approach is commonly called don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. It means military officials can't ask recruits about their sexual orientation, nor can they launch investigations simply to find out if someone's gay. But the official code still says openly homosexual conduct will not be allowed. The president's policy will now be fiercely debated on Capitol Hill. Even before today's announcement, Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn was moving to write the existing ban into law. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
When President Clinton announced his intention to partially lift the ban on homosexuals in the military today, he said it may not make anyone happy. That's true on Capitol Hill, where emotions are mixed. Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank said today the policy is an improvement, but doesn't go far enough. Still, he said the choice was difficult.
A policy which met the principle of non-discrimination but would have lost in Congress versus a policy that is some improvement in the day-to-day lives for military people who are gay or lesbian, but not the victory in principle that we're looking for that could win. The president made that choice. I wish he had made the other choice.
While Frank says the Congress would have overturned a complete lifting of the ban, members may oppose the compromise as well. Senator Nunn is moving legislation that would codify the existing ban into law, and it's considered to have wide support. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton today fired FBI Director William Sessions. The FBI chief was halfway through his 10-year term. In January, a Justice Department report said Sessions abused the privileges of his office. Sessions denied the allegations, calling them trumped-up charges by FBI agents who opposed him. Illinois transportation workers are trying to reopen a Mississippi River bridge connecting southeast Iowa and western Illinois. Bill Wheelhouse of member station WIUM in Macomb, Illinois, has more.
The bridge linking Hamilton, Illinois and Keokuk, Iowa will be the only bridge open for nearly 200 miles north of St. Louis. A levee break at West Quincy, Missouri over the weekend shut off the only link in this region, leading area officials to try to open this bridge to traffic. Workers are laying a blanket of rock on the road to lift it above the flooding water on the Illinois approach. Two of the bridge's four lanes will be open to traffic. Local officials say they expect 26,000 vehicles a day. That is double the normal amount of traffic to travel on this road. They hope to have the bridge open in the next few hours. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Wheelhouse in Hamilton, Illinois.
The skies did clear over much of the flooded Midwest today, and there's little rain in the forecast for tomorrow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed mixed today, gaining almost 7 points, to close at 3535.28. This is NPR. The former head of the House Post Office pleaded guilty today to conspiracy and embezzlement charges. Robert Rota said in the 1970s and 80s he helped two Democratic congressmen get cash illegally from post office funds. While no names are mentioned, court papers indicate the two lawmakers are former Representative John Coulter of Pennsylvania and Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois, the powerful chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. The two men have previously denied any wrongdoing. The last group of more than 600 Chinese boat people was flown back to China today from Mexico, where the refugees arrived over the weekend. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
Mexico's Interior Ministry issued a communique late this afternoon reporting that all 661 Chinese who arrived here aboard three decrepit ocean vessels were returned to China in four flights chartered by the Mexican government. 31 crew members have been placed under arrest. According to the official communique, the deportations were in strict compliance with Mexican law, but officials barred both reporters and the human rights commissioner from the state of Baja California, where the boats landed, from observing the emigres. The boat people were first intercepted nearly 2 weeks ago by the U.S. Coast Guard, 65 miles south of San Diego. After a week of bickering with American officials, Mexico finally accepted the boats. But more trouble may be on the way. A high-ranking Mexican official says at least 19 more boatloads of Chinese emigres have been spotted off the Pacific coast. I'm David Walma in Mexico City.
Iraq and the United Nations have apparently reached agreement on U.N. weapons inspections. U.N. spokesman Joe Sills says the two sides concluded their talks today, and U.N. diplomat Rolf Acheus will meet with the Security Council this week. The Gulf War ceasefire says Iraq must destroy its chemical, biological, and nuclear arms. It also says Baghdad must allow the U.N. to monitor its weapons production. Baghdad has refused to permit U.N. supervision. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to meet the producer and the writer of the film In the Line of Fire. It stars Clint Eastwood as Frank Horrigan, an aging Secret Service agent who's still haunted by the Kennedy assassination. He was on duty then and wonders if he could have prevented the tragedy by stepping into the line of fire and taking the bullet himself. Now he's trying to stop another assassination. John Malkovich plays Mitch Leary, who plans to assassinate the president. As Eastwood tries to track down Malkovich, Malkovich psychologically toys with Eastwood in a series of untraceable phone calls.
Crowley,
why not call me Booth?
Why not Oswald?
Because Booth had flair, panache, the leap to the stage after he shot Lincoln.
Where are you?
Closer than you might imagine. It's very exciting to talk to you. I feel like I know you.
Oh, how's that?
I've read about you, seen photos. You were JFK's favorite agent, the best and the brightest. But that was a long time ago. What's kept you in the game all these years?
Why don't we get together and have a drink? We could talk about that.
Oh, I'd love to, but I think the less you know about me, the better.
Oh, why?
Because I'm planning to kill the president.
In the Line of Fire was 9 years in the making, as one deal after another fell through. My guest Jeff Apple was the one constant during that time. He conceived the film and produced it. Early on, Dustin Hoffman was supposed to star, but for typical Hollywood-type reasons, he had to pull out. Sean Connery and Robert Redford were later possibilities before Clint Eastwood signed. Apple told me he could never have made the film without a big star.
Well, when you're developing a movie, particularly one of this scope, knowing the budget would be about where it was, you need a major motion picture star. And I think you have to be very much aware of what the universe of actors, who they are, and most importantly, could they get the movie made? Because, you know, studios don't make big pictures without a major name. And it turned out in this situation, because we had an older agent, the list of talent who could not only play the role, but could be green-lighted by a studio because of their box office potential, was very limited. It probably, you were talking about a universe of maybe five, six, seven actors max.
Why was it so little? I mean, I would think that there's a lot of older, terrific male stars who are looking for a meaty role.
There are, but there are only a handful that are meaningful in terms of box office. And if you're talking about a $40 million film, that is very important to a studio.
Who's on the list of meaningful of that age group?
Well, Robert Redford, for one, Warren Beatty, Sean Connery. There was a consideration of Paul Newman. But, you know, lately, I don't think there was a sense of his bankability of being able to hinge a whole picture on him of this scope. It's pretty amazing, but it's very limited.
Once you started actually shooting In the Line of Fire, what went differently than what you'd planned?
I would say, in general, what went differently was it was bigger in scope and better than I had ever dreamed. For example, after working on this for 9 years, day one, shot one of our movie was a 40-car motorcade down Pennsylvania Avenue with 3,000 extras, five cameras rolling, and Clint Eastwood, you know, running next to the next to our presidential limo. To me, that was just like, you know, a dream come true. And the entire movie, production-wise, went just like that. It went like clockwork.
What do you have to do to get permission to close off the streets of Washington, D.C. to have a staged motorcade?
Washington, D.C., unfortunately, is, from my experience, the most difficult city to film in this country, without a doubt. And the reason is that there are so many different governmental agencies who have jurisdiction on various different pieces of property. Around the White House, within 20 or 30 feet of the White House, you would encounter probably five different agencies who have owned different or have a jurisdiction over various different areas, you know, from the National Park Service to Washington, D.C. City, to the Secret Service, to the White House, to the Treasury Department. And in order to film in certain areas, you have to get approvals from everybody. It did make it easier for us to have the Secret Service there on our side, who could help usher us into certain areas that they obviously had full control over. And to me, that was very important because I always wanted to be showing Washington in a way that it's never been seen before. We filmed in the interior of the Treasury Department, you know, actual scenes, and right in between the White House and the Treasury Department building as well. And there are a lot of areas there that have never been seen on a big screen movie before.
Anything surprise you about Clint Eastwood's approach to acting in the making of the film?
Well, I had never worked with Clint before, and Wolfgang never had either. And he has a very, very, you know, laid back. I mean, obviously, he's been doing it for a number of years. He's done, you know, untold number of movies. He's the ultimate pro, and I was surprised by his just real relaxed nature in any kind of scene that we were to do. I mean, even where he was doing his own stunts, you know, which I had some concerns about doing, but he didn't. In one of the scenes, he's hanging off a seven-story building, for real. And as the producer of the film, and we're in our second week of production, I was very nervous, although he wasn't.
Was there a net beneath him?
There was no net beneath him. Actually, what we did is he had a comfort level because we were using his old-time buddy and friend, Buddy Van Horn, who not only directed, I think, one or two of his pictures, but also has done all of his stunt work. And he coordinated the security on that. We actually had a harness, which he was harnessed to the building. I mean, he could literally let his hands go and hang there. But it was hidden because it was in his stomach and you'd never know it. But still, hanging off a seven-story building, to me, is takes a lot of guts. I don't care what's holding you on.
Why did he want to do it himself instead of using a stuntman?
Well, because if we were going to try to do any other kind of blue screen or special effects, he was concerned that it would be much more complicated and you wouldn't get the real effect. I mean, he's a director and a filmmaker and was first to say, you know, it's not worth going to that hassle. We can make up this rig and let's shoot it for real.
Jeff Apple produced the film In the Line of Fire. We'll talk with the screenwriter after this break. This is Fresh Air. Several years into the making of In the Line of Fire, producer Jeff Apple was looking for someone to rewrite the screenplay. The production company he was working with wanted him to hire a name writer. Instead, he contacted Jeff McGuire and asked him to write a new script. They had worked together on another unproduced film. McGuire wrote the new script long before he knew Clint Eastwood was going to be the lead. I asked him how he reacted when he found out Eastwood had agreed to play Agent Frank Horrigan.
I was delighted. I must be honest, though, and say, you know, there's some of those long speeches that are in there, especially when he's talking about Dallas, and he gets so emotional. I really wondered if he was going to be able to do that or if he would want to do that. He's always been sort of nonverbal as an actor, and he conveys so much with his expressions and with his body language, and he's so wonderful at that. I really wondered if he was going to be interested in carrying out some of these monologues, but he was incredible. And that take, the scene where he's talking about Dallas and when he actually gets tears in his eyes and his lip is quivering, that was the second take that day. And we all, when that was over, we were all just had goosebumps and there were tears all around the room and everybody knew that that was the one. That was just perfect. And it was remarkable. So while I had a little bit of trepidation going into it, very early on, I just realized, God, there's nobody else who could have done this nearly as well. He was just remarkable, I thought, and a wonderful guy. And I think that something that is that he is so charming and humorous in person, and that's rarely been captured on film. And I think that this, you know, comes closer to capturing what he's like in reality than any role that I can think of.
You didn't know that the role would be played by Clint Eastwood when you were writing the script. Once he was cast, did you write any lines just for him?
No. And that's another interesting thing. I hadn't realized that he played the piano. I hadn't realized a lot of things about him that now seem tailor-made for him. Mm-hmm. While I was writing it, I really, when I'm working on something, I try not to envision any particular actor because you'll inevitably be disappointed if they don't do it, and B, if I knew I was writing it for Clint Eastwood, I probably wouldn't have put in that monologue about Dallas because I wouldn't have thought of him doing that.
This is the second movie in a row where Clint Eastwood has had the flu because, you know, he gets sick in Unforgiven also.
Oh, I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you worry about getting a fever, you notice these things. But, you know, usually a flu or a cold is played for laughs, you know. Sneezes are always played for laughs. And it's actually pretty frightening when he's sick and in such a position of responsibility.
Right. I just mainly wanted to show that the Secret Service agents, they're on their feet 8 hours at a time often. They kind of scarf down fast food when they're on the road. They're constantly on the move. They are often stuck out in the rain. And if it suddenly starts raining and they don't have a trench coat on or a raincoat or whatever, they can't just say, hey, wait a minute, you know, Mr. President, you know, hold your tongue there for a second while I run and get a coat. You know, they have to just take it and stand in the rain. So they're basically susceptible to all kinds of illnesses on the road. And I just wanted to kind of show that and how an older man would be so vulnerable to that. And then after, while you're sick, you might not necessarily be able to get relief. And you're stuck in that situation that he's in a convention center where every face in the crowd suddenly can take on a nasty look, you know, and you can begin to see killers everywhere you look if you're a little bit paranoid and sick, you know, to begin with.
What was your first impression when you heard that John Malkovich would be cast as the would-be assassin?
I was delighted. We had actually talked about some older actors. There was some discussion. At one point, there was even discussion about Jack Nicholson playing him, and Clint actually scheduled a golf game with Jack to talk about it. And I think Jack, though, was busy with something else. And I was always trying to get it. I wrote it to be a younger man. And I always liked the idea that Clint was kind of the Kennedy generation and that the killer was of the Vietnam generation. And there was something about that dynamic that I thought was interesting. And so when John Malkovich was cast, I hadn't thought of him at first, but immediately I said, oh, yeah, he's such a great chameleon and can just inhabit those different personalities that he plays. And so it was great because, you know, the various disguises and the various personas that he adopts in the film, he just does so convincingly.
So Clint Eastwood doesn't like to rehearse. What about John Malkovich? I bet he likes to rehearse.
No, you know something? He was incredible because he would just show up and, you know, he knew his lines. He always knew the lines and he would just do them. And if we came and said, John, let's, and sometimes he would show up and we would have, you know, Wolfgang and I would have played with it the night before and we would give him, you know, new lines or we would have cut some lines and he would always just go, okay. And he never complained. He never, I kind of figured being such an intense actor, I really expected that he would want to talk about his character and that we would go into, you know, all sorts of, you know, back and forth wordplay over, you know, his motivation or something like that. He never got into that at all. He was just very, very much of a, almost just took a workmanlike stance and just did the job. Some of the other actors, none of the principals, but some of the people who just came in and worked for 1 or 2 days would take me aside and talk to me for 2 hours about their characters and want to know about the motivation and want to know about each line and all that, which was kind of amusing. And yet, you know, they did a great job, so I don't complain about it. But Clint and John, you know, Dylan, Renee, John Mahoney, they all were just very workmanlike about it and just went about their jobs. And it was a delightful set. Everybody got along so well.
Was in reading about the movie, it sounds like there was one part where you were asked to rewrite the script for Tom Cruise to play the role that Clint Eastwood plays now.
Yeah. When we went to Imagine Entertainment, this was like the week before the bidding war got started, so it hadn't been sold or anything. And they had liked the script very much, but I guess they had a relationship with Tom Cruise and they were looking for something for him to do. And they said, would you be interested in changing it to a 28-year-old agent? And Jeff Apple and I both kind of blanched at the thought, and I said, well, you'd kind of lose the backstory. And they said, yeah, well, you'd have to come up with a new backstory. And I said, well, I don't want to sound pretentious or anything, but I think that the Kennedy backstory is one of the real things that makes the story what it is, that this in this one Secret Service agent trying to heal the wounds that the Kennedy assassination left, I think that, you know, maybe the whole country needs to heal that wound. And I think that's one of the reasons why people respond to the script. And basically we said, thank you very much, and we left. And at that point, I was getting calls daily from creditors asking where the money was, and I had to go home and tell my wife that I just turned down a major sum of money to, you know, that would involve changing the script. And fortunately, she said she'd rather live in a shack than see me change the script. And then a week later, you know, everything was fine because of the script sold to Castle Rock. So, yeah, that was just one brief incident, and it was kind of amusing. Yeah.
Jeff McGuire wrote the screenplay for the film In the Line of Fire. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton addressed the nation today on his policy on gays in the military. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing a report about the president's speech before the National Defense University, in which he outlined a policy that will be based on conduct, not on sexual orientation. It has a far more subtle position that we'll hear more about on declarations of sexual orientation. Also on today's program, we'll hear about President Clinton and FBI Director Sessions, the latest from the floods in and around St. Louis, and also the good news about health in Des Moines, Iowa, after all these floods, and also a talk with Bernard Lewis, the Islamicist, about Islam and the West.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sally Potter's movie Orlando is based on the story of the same name by Virginia Woolf. You may have heard this film praised as an artistic literary inquiry into the nature of gender. But you won't hear that from our film critic Stephen Schiff.
Orlando is the emperor's new clothes in reverse. The clothes are there all right, in abundance. There's just no emperor inside them. I have friends who've told me how wonderful the movie is, only to confess a few minutes later that they kept falling asleep watching it. In fact, I don't know too many people who've made it all the way through without a snooze or two, and this movie's barely an hour and a half long. What's going on here? Audiences are being hoodwinked, that's what. Orlando's period costumes and settings are so sumptuous that it takes a while to realize that they are more or less the whole show. This movie isn't about anything, but but it dresses as though it were, and people who doze through it can come out feeling more refined simply because they've been exposed to a museum-quality wardrobe. The Virginia Woolf novel is not one of her great works. It's really a sort of comic piffle. But it's amusing and gorgeously written. Woolf meant it as a joke biography of the woman she loved, the bisexual Vita Sackville West, whom Woolf turned into Orlando, an English nobleman born in the Elizabethan era. In the movie, Queen Elizabeth herself, played by Quentin Crisp, commands Orlando never to age or die, and so he doesn't. As played by Tilda Swinton, he remains young through the centuries, and about halfway through conveniently turns into a woman to escape being killed on the battlefield. This at least gives the movie the semblance of a subject, because from here on out it becomes a very mild but very self-important feminist rant, as in this scene, in which the newly female Orlando visits Jonathan Swift, Alexander Pope, and Joseph Addison, all of whom promptly demonstrate what chauvinist pigs they are.
Gentlemen, I find it strange. You are poets, each one of you, and speak of your muse in the feminine, and yet you appear to feel neither tenderness nor respect towards your wives nor towards females in general.
Madam, I have only the highest regard and purest respect for females.
I find no evidence of that sentiment in your conversation.
Conversation is the place where one plays with ideas, my dear lady. Though one forges them quite alone.
Quite so.
Quite. The intellect is a solitary place, and therefore quite unsuitable a terrain for females who must discover their natures through the guidance of a father or husband.
And if she has neither?
Then, however charming she may be, dear lady, she's lost.
I don't know how much pleasure audiences can be expected to get from booing and hissing at obviously idiotic statements like that one, but strangely enough, that scene is the movie's verbal high point. Most of the rest of it is about watching Tilda Swinton flounce around in her elephantine costumes, waiting for someone to make a chauvinist remark, whereupon she turns to the camera and deposits a knowing Mona Lisa smile. The only way this movie could ever have worked would have been if the character of Orlando herself, or himself, had captivated the audience, so that we cheered her on as she rose or suffered with her as she fell. But Tilda Swinton isn't so much an actress as she is a piece of weird furniture. Her Orlando seems calculated mainly to blend with the Aubusson carpet and the Queen Anne commode. You might find yourself blending uncontrollably into your theater seat.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Bob Alls, Ron Barron, and Chris Fraley. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last week, the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue tried to stop abortions in seven cities across the United States. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the founder of Operation Rescue, Randall Terry, and we'll hear from the director of a group of privately run abortion clinics. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.